Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to take your seats, we can start with this best practice forum.
So may I say at the beginning that we do have interpretation in this room, Portuguese and English. So you may express yourself in these two languages, but of course you will need a headset to understand the respective other language. May I welcome you very warmly to this best practice forum, which has the theme Public Participation in Internet Governance.
Louder,
please.
Public Participation in Internet Governance. Is that better? Thank you. Emerging issues, best practices, and proposed solutions. This theme...
Oh, thank you, yes. Very good.
This theme does not fit exactly into any of the major themes discussed at this Internet Governance Forum, and this is why it is not one of the workshops that falls under one of the four major issues. It is, in fact, a theme that cuts across the boundaries of several of these issues. It's relevant for access issues. It's relevant as well for openness issues. This Best Practices Forum is being co-organized by the United Nations Economic Commission for Europe, the Council of Europe, and the Association for Progressive Communication. My name is Michael Remmert. I'm a project manager at the Council of Europe on e-democracy. I have to start by saying that I have to present the apologies of the Deputy Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Mrs. De Boer Bukikyo, who was scheduled to hold to give an opening address to you. Unfortunately, she had to leave in order to catch a plane because we have very adverse weather conditions. So apologies from Mrs. De Boer Bukikyo. I will be reading the speech in her place in a moment. Before doing that, however, I would like to introduce to you the panelists this evening. To my right, Mr. Hans Hansel, the chairman of the UNECE ICT Group for Development, who will be speaking to us about the principles of the Aarhus Convention and their possible applicability to the international forums that have a significant impact on the environment. To my left, Mrs. Andriette Ester, who is the executive director of the Association for Progressive Communications, and Pavel Antonov of Blue Link Bulgaria, also active within the framework of APC. We would like to explore the issue at which level we should be envisaging public participation in internet governance, how to involve all the relevant stakeholders, what methods and e-participation tools could be used, and how they could be combined with online participatory methods. We would like to share experience coming from the Aarhus Convention on the one hand and from the work of the Council of Europe on e-democracy on the other. And perhaps most importantly, we would like to share with you and experience that you might have had in terms of public participation at different levels of internet governance to discuss with you how participation could be enhanced. Obviously, the Internet Governance Forum itself is an important place for participation of different stakeholders, yet at the same time, the Internet Governance Forum is not a decision-making body. So that, of course, puts relativizes the value of public participation. There is some civil society input at ICANN as well, but there are, and we believe there should be, other forms of public participation at different levels. Okay, it works again. So I would like to start with reading out the opening address of the Deputy Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Mrs. Maud de Boer Bukikyo. Ladies and gentlemen, the ever-growing number of internet users and the availability of tools for e-participation broaden the scope for public participation in policy making in the internet governance field. My starting point when talking about internet governance in general is that the internet is, after all, made by and is an affair of people, not machines. The latter are just the technical tools to enable people to play, work, communicate, do business, learn, empower themselves on the internet. Ultimately, it all boils down to people behind machines, to their rights and their duties, and their potential impact onto this e-world. Indeed, ICT have a tremendous potential for empowering people, for shifting power from the center to the people, from them to us. Millions of people engage in all sorts of transactions online, download information, and entertainment. But the internet also provides new spaces for democratic participation and engagement. Using ICT for public participation has the potential to strengthen relationships between citizens and public bodies, to build civic capacity, and to make policymaking more transparent and genuinely participative. In other words, to give the ownership of the internet to us, to the users. The UNECE Aarhus Convention has shown impressively the effects that public participation can have on policy processes in the environmental field. Firstly, the transparency of environmental policies has greatly increased. Secondly, the distribution of information and knowledge through the mechanisms initiated by the convention have raised public awareness of environmental matters and have had important educational effects, often leading to better acceptance of policy measures. And most importantly, each individual can control the compliance of governments with legislation and point out deficits. What can be drawn from experience with the Aarhus Convention for Internet Governance? Can we compare environmental resources with internet resources? Transparency, information and knowledge, and control are the keywords here. In the environmental context, environmental resources such as clean drinking water are often being referred to as public goods that should be available to people free of charge or at a reasonable cost. When it comes to the resources provided to the public by the internet, I should like to propose to you the concept of public service value of the internet. The Council of Europe advances this concept, which is to be understood as people's significant reliance and impact on the internet as an essential tool for their everyday activities and the resulting legitimate expectation that internet services are accessible and affordable, secure, reliable, and ongoing. In fact, the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe, the governing body of the 47 members of the Council of Europe, adopted a week ago a new international standards with its recommendation on measures to promote the public service value of the internet. The recommendation embraces the key IGF themes: openness, security, access, and diversity. In that respect, we may indeed compare environmental resources with internet resources and ask ourselves whether an approach to public participation similar to that in the environmental field should be considered for internet governance. Shouldn't national governments enable the average internet user to be informed about issues of internet governance? For internet governance processes to satisfy democratic needs and for the responses provided to be truly people-centered, the part to be played by users should be recognized and strengthened. Is it fair that users are just those who subscribe a contract with an internet service provider or just the ultimate chain of the market system? I don't think so. I firmly believe that users should be more than numbers on business contracts. They are and should be considered as real actors of the internet who must be able to play a key role and have an impact on internet governance. Many aspects of internet governance affect users directly: spam, viruses, crime, copyright. Through their direct exposure to these phenomena, internet users can draw the attention of policymakers to the critical issues and contribute to the development of appropriate policies. Moreover, the involvement of users can also help to reduce a certain technology bias that is often found in discussions on internet governance. We know that e-tools can be used at different levels of public involvement. They can be used to inform, to consult, to involve, to collaborate, and finally to empower. In this respect, we at the Council of Europe are currently preparing a set of e-democracy tools based on existing applications in our member states. We also actively contribute to the working group on e-participation in the context of the action line follow-up to WISIS. We therefore want to contribute to bringing people together, bringing together people, technology, and democratic participation in the field of internet governance. We want the internet to be a real democratic space with rules which enable our collective and peaceful coexistence on the internet, but also, and most importantly, which enable people to have a say on what internet should be or not be, and on how the internet can help increase public participation and engagement. I look forward to our discussions and thank you for your attention. This was the speech by Deputy Secretary General. Thank you for your attention. I would now like to give the floor to Hans Hansel, who will be speaking to us about the principles of the Aarhus Convention on Public Participation in Environmental Matters. And we can take this as a starting point for our discussion on different conceivable ways of public participation in internet governance. Hans, the floor is yours.
Borrow this one. Thank you, Michael, for giving me the floor. It's a pleasure to be here. It's in particular interesting for me from DC. I was going to speak about the Aarhus Convention because the Aarhus Convention has a roots in Rio. Aarhus is a town in Denmark. It's spelled with two A, but it pronounced in Danish O. Don't ask me how I know that, but I'm not Danish. But actually, this has a root in Rio. It comes from the Earth Summit 92, when there was this declaration adopted by all the member states on the Rio Declaration on Environment and Development, and Article 10 deals with participation, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. But I think, just to pick up a little bit what Michael said, I think the real questions here is which level should be envisaged for participation in internet governance, and what methods and e-participation tools should be used, what is needed to ensure that citizens can participate in a meaningful internet governance decision-making processes, and I think these are, you mentioned some of them, but I think these are the type of questions we should focus on. What I will do is I will contribute our experience with regard to the Aarhus Convention, and I'll come back in just a second to detail that a little bit more, and also two follow-up decisions to the Aarhus Convention, a couple of guidelines that was adopted in Almaty, Kazakhstan, 2005, and also some tools on some recommendation on electronic tools. But if we go and look a little bit closer to on the ORIS Convention. Actually, it's called the Convention on Access to Information, Public Participation in Decision-Making, and Access to Justice in Environmental Matters. I can hardly say that, but it's called the Aarhus Convention. It's much easier to say. And it was adopted in 1998 in Aarhus. And it's a new kind of environmental agreement. It links environmental rights and human rights, acknowledge that we owe an obligation to future generations. It established that sustainable development can be achieved only through the involvement of all stakeholders. It links government accountability and environmental protection. It focuses on interactions between the public and public authorities in a democratic context and is forging a new process for public participation. The Aarhus Convention grants the public rights and imposes on parties and public authorities obligations regarding access to information and public participation and access to justice. also, this is developed by the convention developed by the ECE, and ECE is an Economic Commission for Europe. It's a regional organization. The scope is global, and it is the most ambitious, as Kofi Annan said, a venture in the area of environmental democracy, and we recommend it for other environment decision-making in other environmental organizations. As I said, it comes from the Rio Declaration that was adopted in 92, and I had to look it up myself, so... Yes. Yes, I found it. The internet is a wonderful tool. You just click and there it is. You go to UNEP and there it is. And Principle 10 of this Rio Declaration says that environmental issues are best handled with the participation of all concerned citizens at the relevant level. At the national level, each individual shall have appropriate access to information concerning the environment that is held by public authorities, including information on hazardous material and activities in their communities, and the opportunity to participate in decision-making processes. States shall facilitate and encourage public awareness and participation by making information widely available. Effective access to judicial and administrative proceedings, including redress and remedy, shall be provided. This was 92, and I think it was quite foresighted to come up with that declaration at that point of time. The convention has 41 parties, including the European Community. we see it as a model of good governance and recognize the importance of respective roles of citizens and enables active participation of NGOs in all processes of the convention. It promotes application of the principles of the convention in international forums dealing with environmental matters and recognizes desirability of transparency in all branches of government. I'd like to say this up front that this is an environmental convention, so we can draw parallels, but I'm not saying that this should apply in all other fora, so I'll just make that very clear. The convention rests on three pillars. As I said, authorities should make information available, encourage participation, but the third pillar is also justice, and with that it's meant that individuals can request information and authorities are obliged to provide information within 30 days. And would they not receive information, the individuals can go to legal proceedings. Some of the provisions, important one with regard to policy, is that there should be provisions that the public can participate. There should be reasonable time frames for the public to be informed and they should be encouraged to participate as early as possible. However, there are also some provisions that weaken the status of the public, and it says that the due outcome to be taken of the outcome of public participation, there's a due outcome, it doesn't say that must follow all the suggestions coming from this public participation. And there are also a general obligation, but only to the extent appropriate, to include the public in participation in the public decision-making processes. If it's not feasible to pack 1,000 people in a room for 100, then you choose 100. Also, with regard to the normative aspect, that they should one should strive to promote effective public participation. And this applies to rules that have a significant effect on the environment, and there should be time frames and comments to be fixed. After a couple of years after the convention was adopted, there was a follow-up, and there were some development, and these are the so-called Almaty guidelines. And they promote application of the principles in international environment decision-making processes and within the framework of international organizations in matters related to environment. So it promotes these principles not only in under the convention, but in other bodies as well, but still within the environment. It's also one made very clear that that access is an extremely important point, that the process should be kept open to the public at large, and there should be special measures to be ensure a balanced and equitable process. One should promote transparency, minimize inequality, and avoid the exercise of undue economic and political influence. Also to facilitate the participation of those constituencies that are most directly affected. All official documents should be made available to the public through the internet or through other appropriate means in a timely manner. One should use electronic information tools and, for example, also use webcasting and in order to reach a broader public. Obviously, all this includes a matter of resources, and here I think the parties of the convention has been really forward-thinking. The parties, in order to make sure that there is really is a participation, they support financially the participation of civil society organizations. Four civil society organizations in each official meeting at working group and expert level. In addition to these four civil society organizations, the parties also support and pay for 75 non-governmental organizations, representatives in each meetings of the parties. And I think it is quite impressive. It's a trust fund that's been set up, and that trust fund is used to finance the participation. So normally, when the parties meet, there are about 400 people, and there are about 150 are paid for by the parties of the convention as non-governmental and civil society. And the selection of these are done through nominations through non-governmental organizations. In this case, it's a European ECU Forum. And one is also looking at geographical balance and relevant content of meetings. Selection criteria may include field of expertise, sectoral, professional, and other relevant context, and one should also make available documents at the timely at the relevant time scale. One also made a recommendation on electronic tools. And these should address policy, content, and capacity of stakeholders to effectively use electronic tools. And they promote the involvement and provide users of information the development and use of electronic tools. In EC, we have set up what we call a clearinghouse. It's a web portal where we gather information that's from the parties and describe how the mechanism is working. And also there's a possibility to communicate with the party through this web portal. Special training programs linking use of electronic tools to promotion of good governance is also something that is supported by the convention. So, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll stop there. This is an introduction and an example of how a convention, in this case, it's specifically related to environment, but how one has made it clear that in order for this convention to be a living tool, be something useful, it needs participation of civil society, made provisions in the convention to ensure this. Thank you.
The other presentation again.
Yes, thank you very much. Before we move on, may I open the floor for any questions to Hans about the functioning of the Aarhus Convention before we try to make the link between public participation and internet governance. There's a question here by Vinton. Now it works.
Testing. Yeah, it worked. How about that? How do you do this so that you don't make your back in the face of everyone? My question has to do with scale. What is the scale of the population that the Aarhus conventions typically deal with? Are we talking about a town, a region, a country? Are we talking about tens of thousands of potential participants, not all coming to the meeting, but who need to be represented, or 100,000, or 1 million, or 10 million? The reason I'm asking about the scale is that it might be an issue when we talk about public participation on the internet to policy side.
Hello.
Just to be human.
It's okay. Yes. Well, there are 41 parties to the convention now, so obviously this is in the stage of building up. But and we have these tools like clearinghouses that has been developed. I can't say on top of my head if it's 10,000, 100,000, or 1 million people using these tools. But there is a process to develop this, and that's clear. And I have to go back and ask my colleagues if they have made a survey how many people really are using this. We do have these surveys. We're following up, but it's still under development. I mean, it's not that many years ago that it was that fully in force. I can't give you a real figure on how many in each country is doing this. But
could I have a small phone?
Yes.
I don't know which one is working.
Is that working? Yes. I didn't mean to ask how many people are using the system if it's being used in multiple instances. In other words, if I have a particular issue that needs to be dealt with, the Aarhus process is intended to help public participation on that issue. I'm more interested in understanding at what scale any particular issue might be addressed using the convention. Am I making any sense? Suppose, yes, okay, so you have some answers.
I think potentially, if I understand correctly, potentially every citizen in every one of the 41 signatory countries would, by virtue of their governments being signatories, have rights to access to information and public participation. But I think I have a related question, Hans, which is, what is the scale, well, not the scale of numbers, but the type of participation? How does that, maybe if you can give us some examples of the types of decision-making processes and what type of participation Aarhus has facilitated in that? Unless you have an example to share, Pavel.
You can go ahead and share. Thank you. I just wanted to start with saying that we are here, and thank you, Andriette, for starting it. Usually people at the panel are full of answers, but my intuition is that this workshop will have a lot of questions. So what I wanted to do, I'm a journalist, I've worked most of my time with environment and environmental civil society, but also I've spent some time on the side of ICT, and I'm familiar to some extent with this process. So I wanted to share some of the parallels and maybe to some extent answer some of the issues raised, but then probably not to a full extent. And so from the history of Aarhus, the convention, yes, you're right. It's a convention which is instrumental for every individual citizen. What can you do with Aarhus, and what we have done in Eastern Europe, particularly in the societies of transition, is that citizens have been able to go to their government with Aarhus in hand and demand proper information. And that's not only organizations of citizens, not only NGOs, but also individual citizens. So that's one thing. That's the first pillar of Aarhus as presented by Hans. But the second one, which is also very important, is the governments are obliged to involve the citizens in any decisions, any policy processes, or actually practical decisions regarding particular projects regarding environment. So that's where also a very important role of the rights secured by Aarhus comes in. And so we have seen many cases across our region where communities and civil society have been able to access vital information, but also to join the discussions and the decisions being made on regarding vital environmental resources. Of course, there is much more interesting things that can be said about the third pillar, which links the first two with access to justice. And I think that's also fair to make this point here, because apart from being informed and being able to participate, Aarhus provides you with the opportunity to go to court and get justice based on these issues. So governments are liable to their citizens also in court for complying with all these provisions. Now, all this is a very exciting framework, and in my mind and in the mind of many environmentalists, this is all about environment. Now, Andrea, just before the session, gave me a very challenging task to think how could this translate, or what would be the possible implication of all this for the internet governance. And I was thinking there are certainly obvious parallels which could be observed, and but also some differences. Now, the first one I wanted to point, which I came to, it's a similarity, I think, and it's a very exciting thing, is both Aarhus was a quest for civil society originally. That's how it came. Aarhus was an organized effort for years to make sure that citizens are empowered. And so it was in the direction of civil society talking to the governments until they all agreed to have this instrument. What we have in the field of internet, I think we are even more advanced in this aspect, because internet is rooted in the individual initiative. So here we have even, I think, a better starting position in this aspect. Now, the question is, and that's where the big difference comes, Aarhus deals strictly with government. So it's the governments who are responsible to do things and have to provide certain things like information and access. Now, here in the internet field, and I just come from a previous workshop where someone was explaining how many different bodies there are coordinating and deciding and synchronizing. So here you have a much more complicated infrastructure of decision making, and I don't have the feeling there is one government you can go to that should provide you the access. And that's a global issue. In contrast with Aarhus, where you deal with national and local environmental issues mostly. So this is another parallel and a difference there. But the good thing, of course, is the philosophy of Aarhus, which could, I think, be transposed in this process here, which is the fact that whoever makes the decisions, whoever is the government, if there is anyone, should involve the citizens and should inform the citizens, and should also make sure that there is some sort of compliance mechanism. Aarhus deals with courts, but Aarhus has a very good compliance mechanism, and that's a very interesting point I would like to add to the presentation of Hans, which is that it's possible for even for civil society organizations to go to the Aarhus Convention Secretariat and file complaints or signals how the convention is being implemented by their own government. So governments have some responsibility. So all these things put together make me feel that intuitively that Aarhus could be an inspiring model. Of course, it's far from being directly applicable for such a complicated matter. But I would come and I finish here because that was what I was planning to say. The starting point of all my thoughts was what is the issue that the stake, what is at stake in both of the sides? And in the case of Aarhus, we have obviously an issue which everyone by now agrees is of vital importance. It's human health and environment. So basically, if you don't get this information, you're going to be sick or die. And no one can argue this. Now, the question is on the side of internet resources. Can we make the analogy? If you ask me, yes, I'm convinced internet access to internet resources is equally vital for communities, for individual citizens, particularly from the global south, but also everywhere around the world. So, and I think most of the people in this hotel would agree with me, but I'm just wondering whether governments have reached to the stage to also share this understanding whether that internet is of equal access to internet and access to technology is of equal importance as access to good quality of environment resources. And so when we get to the answer, yes, it is, then I think we could easily put in place the participation framework and make sure it works out fine. I stop here. Thank you.
Certainly. I share the views of Pavel. There's no problem with that. But I think also that actually what we are talking, you're talking about health and environment, and in other words, we're talking about public goods. Internet, as I say, is also public goods. And what we have with the Aarhus Convention is a mechanism how to take care of the public goods. How do you sustain it, and I think that's interesting. And we are looking for similar mechanisms with regard to the ozone layer. That's one that we almost managed to resolve, but we have a number of other critical environmental and other issues with regard to public goods. And the main problem often is to find a mechanism how to preserve them and how to sustain public goods. And I think these are the parallels we can draw to internet and internet governance.
Do you want to kick in there?
Andreas, shall we perhaps first take that question here, to which the panel could then react?
I'd like to make a comment. It seems to me that the reason why you're having trouble here is that there's a fundamental point you're skipping over, and that is there is no consensus that the internet is a public good. It's a bumper sticker. The internet is a public good.
The internet is a bumper sticker?
No.
That's a bumper sticker.
The notion that the internet is a public good is a bumper sticker.
Sorry,
yes.
Sorry.
There's an underlying legal issue, and that is, the water may be a public good, the air may be a public good, the ozone may be a public good, but the internet is largely in private hands. You know, it's not a public good. And to take these and to take what is obviously an analogy, is obviously a comparison at most, and to extend it too far, it seems to me it lacks limits on how far the principle extends. And that's, I think, analytically what your problem is. You make a comparison, but you don't ask what are the limits to the comparison. And that's why it breaks down and why it was put in the opening speech as a question. Is it possible to make this comparison? She was smart enough not to actually say it, but to make it a question. And my question is, and it perhaps it's the lawyer's question, I can't avoid what I am, is what analysis has gone into the question of how far the analogy can be extended? What are the limits? Where does it break down? Where is it good?
Yes, very interesting point. Thank you. Could you tell us who you are so we...
Oh, I'm with the American Bar Association. I'm a partner in a global law firm. I practice internet law.
Thank you very much. I take a few other comments and questions because... I take one more back there, and then we go to Andriette. I'm afraid you have to come forward to the stage as we don't have any wireless microphones.
Yves Poulet, professor at the University of Namur. Thanks a lot for this marvelous debate and this presentation. It was quite interesting for me. I had a question. I am not sure that we are addressing the right question to the right actor. What I have in mind is the following point. It seems that more and more our interaction in the cyberspace are framed and shaped by technological choices. I can take two examples, cookies, and cookies has been developed by a request for comment coming from ITF. I can take another example, RFID. Nobody is discussing about RFID, and RFID is invading our life or daily life more and more. So my problem is to say that with Aarhus Convention we are organizing certain right of the citizens against the state. But what about a public debate about choice which are done by standardization authorities, which must be private authorities and which are it is quite clear, dominated by certain business companies.
Thank you. I'd like to turn to Andriette now.
Well, thanks, Michael. In fact, my presentation actually responds precisely to these questions. And I think, well, before I go into what my organization, Association for Progressive Communications, has in mind, just to reflect a little bit more on this context, I think that, yes, there's definitely no consensus on the internet being a public good or not, but there is a common understanding that it's cross-border and possibly interplanetary soon, if not already. It also, and then if you look at internet governance, it's very dispersed. But unlike governance in the environmental sector, it's not just dispersed across geographical regions where you have to deal with the fact that the environment does not respect national borders, but you are dealing with national entities. In the internet, you're not. You're dealing with a very diverse mix of entities. Some are governmental, actually very few probably, some are intergovernmental. Some are consortia that set standards, companies that get together. Some are like country code TLDs, top-level domains, are self-organized groups at national level. So they are incredibly diverse. But they also have a lot in common. I think there is, in the same way that Pavel talked about the philosophy of the Aarhus Convention, there is also a philosophy in the internet that it is a very user-driven entity. And of course it's very contested because of the way in which corporations are claiming space and closing processes on the internet and because of the way in which governments are seeking control. So I think the other very diverse thing about internet governance is not just the different types of institutions that are involved, but the types of decisions, as I said, from standards to rules to policies to national ICT strategies to issues around content and censorship. So it's incredibly diverse. And at the technical level, some could become very profound. You mentioned RFIDs. But then we have the IGF, and we also went through the World Summit on the Information Society. And some decisions were made. At the WSIS, the WSIS principles of participation were agreed on by all stakeholders involved, private sector, governments, and civil society. The Geneva Declaration also affirms the importance of human rights in all aspects of developing the information society, and that includes internet governance. So there is something there to work with. And then we have a precedent in the internet community and in the IGF of online participation, the kind of e-participation that you were talking about in the context of AROS. Groups like the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force, has been working remotely and electronically for many, many years. ICANN has a tradition of facilitating remote participation. The IGF is trying to facilitate remote participation. So there is a spirit of that. But how do you retain that, and how do you build on that in a way that is more systematic than just having an IGF once a year? And what we want to suggest is something new, but that uses the AROS Convention as a prototype. And essentially, it would be an agreement. You can call it the Rio Agreement or the Rio Convention. But an agreement to which a self-regulatory agreement to which different institutions involved in internet governance can become signatories. And it doesn't matter if they are not-for-profit corporations or a government department or the ITU or a particular scientific research grouping. It would just create the opportunity for this diverse range of institutions, which could also include governments that are involved in internet governance in some way, to commit to a common understanding and common commitment of participation, access to information, and transparency. And probably some of them would find it very easy to become members of such an agreement or commitment, but some would not. And they would probably be need for applying pressure. We've heard today about standards. I attended a workshop earlier about the closedness of ICT standards. But an agreement like this could be used to put pressure on a very private sector-based standard-setting group, which in general doesn't have account. They're not accountable to anyone, actually, other than themselves and their shareholders. But one could use something like this as a sort of soft power, public pressure mechanism. And it can achieve more voice for consumers, a space for users to speak out, to demand participation in decisions and decision-making that impact on them. It can also help finance. Hans was mentioning how AROS has helped to create a trust that finances the participation of civil society in particular. We need that in the IGF. We need that in internet governance. There are many people that want to be here and that need to. They could be from a developing country. They could be a young entrepreneur or a scientist, an inventor that's unable to finance their own way to a forum like this. So these are the ideas, and I think, but like Pavel and our other panelists, I mean, we are coming here with questions. Do you think something like this can work? Could it perhaps be a non-threatening starting point for creating more inclusion, more participation, more collaboration, but without challenging the existing configuration of institutions, which generally just results in deadlock when one starts talking about that? But we see it as something that could underpin change in the longer term without forcing, in the shorter term, any particular transfer of decision-making power from one body to another.
Thank you. So that sounds like a concrete proposal of using the Aarhus Convention as a model, not for a legally binding instrument, but rather something softer, a self-regulating tool that would bring together the different actors in internet governance. Open question on which issues and how would we group these issues in order to come to terms with the diversity of the issues. I think there's a number of reactions to this. I'd like to take them from the front to the back, if I may. the gentleman in the first row here. And again, please use the microphones up front here.
Well, thank you very much.
And please identify yourselves.
Well, I'm Niels Sebergeberfeld from the Federal Republic of Germany. This agreement you were alluding to, was it an agreement for all stakeholders? Was it an agreement which was to be enforced? Because the moment you wish to have enforceability of an agreement, surely there you have to have the governments involved. And at that point, I see tiny difficulties with that kind of agreement. Surely it's always nice to have agreements, but, you can surely involve all the stakeholders possible, no question about it. And the stakeholders themselves may oblige themselves to implement. But then again, in order to have legal means to follow up on that, at that moment, it may start to become a bit difficult.
Perhaps the term a memorandum of understanding would be more appropriate. No, we are thinking of it at this point in time certainly not as anything that is legally binding, but that begins to set some processes and commitments to participation and access to information in place. But it can still form a basis for advocacy, even if it's not a basis for litigation.
Thank you. Take the next question.
Margaret Moran, MP from the UK. I want to absolutely agree with Andrea. I think that that is an excellent way forward, because in many countries, and the UK is an example, we have been struggling with the idea of how we have real citizen engagement and discussion. And it seems to me almost that we're living in parallel worlds. Here we are at the IGF with all of the stakeholders who have an interest in this debate, whilst out there in the real world, people are getting on with all sorts of things that none of us have ever anticipated, you know, the social networking. They are getting on in the real world of the internet and devising their own rules of internet governance, some of which we may approve of and some of which we may not, but it's happening. And the danger is that we're going to have parallel worlds here unless we have the involvement of users at the heart of what we do and not just as an add-on. And in the UK, we've been talking about, in fact, they're discussing it next door, perhaps having a UK-wide IGF. And the instant reaction is, well, we'll have government involved, we'll have parliament involved, and we'll have NGOs involved. But what about the real people? We've got to find mechanisms to have them really at the heart of what's going on, because they can help us to deal with some of what I call the wicked issues. The fact that we come to IGF conferences and we have these perpetual debates about who owns the web. Actually, most people are not particularly interested in that out there. They're busy using the web, and we need to help enable them to have their voices heard in places like this where it matters. And it is most important, and this is where I think this is a real opportunity, it is most important that we hear the voices of the usually unheard, whether it is from countries where they are less empowered because of the lack of technology, or in other circumstances, people who are more socially excluded. We cannot have an internet governance forum where the likes of us sit around talking to each other. We've got to have, if we're going to have anything real here, we've got to empower people whose voices are not usually heard to have their views heard at the heart of the government's governance debate.
I think you need to come.
Yes, you have to come. Up front.
Hello. Yes, my name is Kieran McCarthy, and I'm ICANN's General Manager of Public Participation. That's my job title. So, I was just having a look on the internet, and I've never heard of this Our House Convention. I was just reading through it all, and I couldn't find anything that we don't already have in ICANN. Everything is published there. My job is to try and encourage people. The problem I have is getting people to come. So I think this might be a very useful structure. If everyone agrees to sort of this will be the rules that we follow, maybe people will get used to that, and then people will think, I will go to that body and I will participate in this manner. What I'd be very interested in knowing is what the practicality of it is. What's the systems in place with this convention? Because that's what I'm trying to create in my job, is a way in which people can put their information in, a way in which the organization can then use that information. And we're wide open to this. We want more people to participate in ICANN. More people, the more solid and stable it is. So I think it's an excellent idea, and I hope you've got some slides or information about how you actually practically do it.
Yeah. Andrea urgently wants to respond to that.
Hans needs to respond to your question about how AROS does it. I just want to say that if the ITU was as open and accessible and transparent as ICANN, I would be a much happier citizen of the African continent where there's just not enough access.
Thank you. We would be very happy to provide you with more detailed information how the actual interchange of views and participation takes place with Aarhus. We have regular follow-ups and we have surveys, and so there is a continuing dialogue or participation, whatever you would like to call it. I'm very happy to provide that information to you. I don't have it on top of my head. I'm sorry, I can't say by numbers of figures how many thousand or hundreds or whatever, but we only know that it's crucial in many cases, and like Pavel said, I mean, it is a key tool in some instances for decision making. So I'm very happy to do that. However, Mr. Chairman, if you allow me, I just wanted to react a little bit to our lawyer who came in and made a comment about public goods. I mentioned public goods. It's an economic term, not a legal term. And if it goes something, don't quote me on the definition, but if I use part of a public good, it doesn't cost Vincent or somebody else something. It is you can share it with many without adding any cost, and it doesn't matter if it's owned by a government, a private industry, or an organization. Peacekeeping, education, water, air—all this is regarded as public goods. So, in my view, as an economist, internet is clearly public goods. I have no doubt in my mind, personally, that it's a question. And what we are discussing here is how do we maintain it, how do we make sure it fulfills our requirements. And we had our lady here from Great Britain who discussed the British version. On a global level, public goods has been discussed for quite some time. And for example, Jacques Chirac suggested a tax on airplane tickets in order to finance public goods. That didn't go through. I'm just saying that we should not be afraid for unconventional methods. We should think out of the box, and all possible means that make the trick there, we should use them. So that's, I think this brainstorm that we have today is just a starting point for this type of discussion.
Yes, thank you. I do notice that we have quite some competition, which is more on the social side here, so I do promise that we do not overrun, but I do see that there is still quite a vivid interest. So I take the question from the gentleman next, and then we carry on with all those who want to speak.
I think we should let that is also someone.
Yes.
Hello.
Just speak, he will.
My name is Izumi. I'm the member of the At-Large Advisory Committee of ICANN, who's been sort of with the ICANN's community making efforts to realize the meaningful participation of At-Large or the users into the ICANN process. And so I heard with great interest about AHA's convention. My question with comment is, how do you measure the impact of the citizen participation to the decision making? Is there any such a thing? Or the other, vice versa, how much these participants been satisfied? Or sometimes, and in which degree? Because as many of you may know, that in ICANN context, there's debate about how much you would participate in the decision making, or be it advisory, or even if, when we made some advisory suggestions, how much have been heard, impacted, and there are different views about that. Sometimes if what we suggested hasn't been really adopted, then there's big room of so dissatisfaction, which may sort of, you know, leave them out. If you don't get the return on investment, how much more you would like to participate. But it's a very difficult process because you cannot really satisfy those who want to participate. And also there's some financial side that what I'm grappling like in the cost of global governance, who will share that? Because for the developing countries folks or some civil societies, especially from where the civil society is not really well established inside in the society like East Asia or Africa or other areas, you need to really do outreach and also financially support, and you need to do, as you know, the capacity building. So how do you really measure, and does it scale? To what extent, and so how do you justify this? It's a sort of constant question that we have to face. So I'd like to hear any comments or some practices from the AHAS or related areas. Thank you.
I think we'll have to collect a few questions and then answer them all together. I take the gentleman from there, followed by the lady over here. Either one.
Okay. My name is Ayman Al-Sharbini. I'm working for the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Western Asia. I think that the idea of similarity between the environmental paradigm and the ICT paradigm is very inspiring. Without going into details of similarities and differences, the idea is to try, I mean, the essence of it is to try to find a certain framework to which the players should subscribe to. And the core strengths of the idea is that at the end of the day, there is some accountability. So, I mean, this is the essence. We don't have to, I mean, debate a lot specific issues. The essence here is to try to find some outcome for the RGF. And this outcome is some kind of MOU or call it a declaration or whatever it is, framework, public participation framework. At the end, it should be like creating some accountability on the players. And the analogy is simple. I mean, in the environment, it was citizens and governments. Here it is users at large and players. It's very simple. I mean, there is no problem in it. We can adjust it. And I mean, the most inspiring thing out of it is that there is some outcome to which we will achieve at the end of the day. So I strongly encourage us to abstract the idea or abstract the proposal. And this is, I mean, there is no contradiction with what ICANN is doing or whatsoever is doing, because it is not, as you said, to challenge one's position, but it is like to create an accountable constitution, kind of, for to which all players are accountable, and this can also help participation by everyone, every other player like ITU and others. So I strongly agree to it, regardless of the differences or of the similarities. I hope this can be an outcome for you. I hope. Just put one it of
the outcomes. Thank you very much. Floor is to you.
Thank you. My name is Charlotte Dani from the University of Bremen in Germany. And as far as I understood it, we are thinking about tools for e-participation and online participation, especially to include those citizens of the world that have been excluded so far from the discourse on internet governance, for example. And that means basically also people in developing countries. But since we know that many people, especially there, just lack the access to online tools, to ICT, how do we empower these people by providing e-tools?
Thank you. You're next. Yes.
Yes, hello, my name is Jonathan Zook, and I'm with the Association for Competitive Technology. And it's often my job to throw water on conversations, so I'll try to do that here. Having read my Alexis de Tocqueville, There's a lot of challenges associated with democracy in general and e-democracy, et cetera. And so one of the questions we have to ask is not only is the internet a public good, but what do we mean by the public? Because right now we have largely representative systems around the world, and there's a bunch of people that claim to represent the public. Governments believe that their role is, in fact, to represent the interests of the public. Corporations believe that through the workings of the marketplace that they end up representing, by default, the interests of the public. And civil society, such as it's defined, speaks of themselves as representing the public, even though there's very often no connection whatsoever between them and the public. So is the question individual people, we often refer to as Joe Sixpack, right? Is it this individual guy that's taking time away from the barbecue to come participate in this process? Or are we really talking about this very politically laden process of civil society and business and government fighting for control, pushing people to go to these online sites and polls and things like that? Are we really creating an incremental participation by the quote-unquote public? Or are we really creating a rhetorical advance in public participation that is really an extension of existing politics by other means?
Good evening. My name is William Stuckey, and I'm from AFRISPA, the African Association of ISP Associations. AFRISPA represents associations of ISPs, which in turn represents commercial organizations and non-profit organizations. So that answers that question. I'm also from a developing country in Africa. The lady from Britain touched on the issue of access to technology as being an inhibiting factor. In many developing countries, particularly in Africa, the problem is not access to technology. There are lots of clever people, lots of geeks in Africa. They know how to use the technology. The problem is government legislation. Government-supported monopolies, excessive licensing fees, excessive licensing regimes that make it difficult or impossible to put in the infrastructure that we need to provide sufficient communications in Africa.
Thank you. And there was one final question. Would you like to ask it now?
Hello, my name is Marilia. I'm from the Federal University of Santa Maria here in Brazil. Actually, I have two questions. One is about the pillar of participation and the other about the pillar of jurisdiction. And the first one, to participate, like you said, it's necessary to be online because most of the institutions, they are far away from the citizens. So we're talking about online participation. And I was wondering how to materialize this kind of participation. We have an experience in European Union, is the interactive policy making. Most of the important policies, they get online. And we have questions about these policies, like the citizens can answer to specific questions, whether they agree or not with the proposition of the policy. But this is, in my opinion, has a flaw, because when you make the questions, like, the people are limited to say what they want, you know? The people that ask the questions, they have the power to give the agenda, they have the power to set what is being discussed or not. So I wonder how this could be materialized in the field that you are talking about. And also in European Union, they had an idea to construct forums, like not only make questions, but give the people the opportunity to discuss with the policy-making people about what they are discussing on their meetings. But their forums, they don't happen since 2005. So I wonder why they don't happen anymore. Maybe you could answer a little about that, because I think it would be an idea, online forums. And also about digital inclusion. I wanted that to discuss a little more about that, because even on European Union we have a policy like I-2010, I believe, that talks about digital inclusion, but even in Europe the levels of digital inclusion are very different. Like you have 80% and 20% on the East countries like Bulgaria, for instance. So it's like a big challenge even in Europe, and for us don't have even to say it, to talk about it. And finally, the juridical pillar. I think the two pillars, they won't come true if we don't have a juridical pillar. If citizens, like which court they're going to recur if there's a problem. If their governments or the institutions, they don't offer information or channels for participation, which court is going to be responsible for that? Maybe the UN court, but I don't see they now how could it be done, because they don't have the competency and they're not actually very efficient on what they do right now. So who would take the responsibility? That's it.
Thank you for all these questions and challenges. The challenge now is to wrap up within the next 5 minutes, and I would like to do that in the sense that I would give each of the three panelists an opportunity to react and then try myself to very briefly sum up at least some of the pertinent of the questions that have been brought up, because I think answers we haven't found very many tonight, but this is a beginning of a process as we see it, and therefore very useful. So I'd like to start with Hans, please. Yeah, the floor.
Thank you. I think there were quite some excellent questions here, but maybe we are asking a little bit too much sometimes about the Aarhus Convention. We can't answer all of these questions. There were, for example, questions related to the cost. I mean, the Aarhus Convention, there have been these follow-ups. And some of the constraints is, of course, that in some countries people they can't afford to access internet, and that's the same as developing countries, the same as the problem with all in electronic development. Another issue is it one person or is it an organization that makes influence or presses for influence? But this is a democracy issue. I mean, it's the same in any political country or association. It could be one person, it could be an ideological NGO or whatever, or a political party. I mean, so that's the same. I can't see that it really makes very much of a difference. I think we have, in addition, in the Aarhus, we have done follow-up. We are looking at the actual application. We are looking at the figures. I don't have them. But one should remember that this is national implementations. I mean, it's not an international. I represent EC. There are 56 member states. I don't have the figures for the implementation of all these 56 member states. But I think that's a very good question. And maybe we could go back and ask this to our secretariat. And then we can come back. And I know that they have done studies on what are the constraints and how they can improve the application of the convention. But these are very good questions, and I'm very happy to report this back to you at some future meeting.
Pavel clearly wants the last word.
No.
That's fine. Yes, I think that, thanks for the questions. And I think firstly, I think we have to recognize that we are also talking about two related but different things. Aarhus is an intergovernmental a convention to which governments are signatory and regional institutions, and it works. And I think that is very important. It works, and it's been proven to work. What we are thinking of is something different. More of an agreement between a much more diverse range of institutions that are involved in internet governance. So it is very different. But before I say more about that, just to respond to people, the question about people in developing countries, people who have access. The internet, I also believe it's a public good, but even if you believe it's an opportunity for making money, you don't actually have to have individual access to it in order for it to be relevant in your life, in your economy, in your business. And I think that's very important. The internet has become so ubiquitous that it's equally important if you are an aged person and remote somewhere in the United Kingdom and your children are all in Australia, you don't know how to use the internet. You have a stake in that. Being able to send email can strengthen ties with family. So I think that whether you connect it or not, we kind of are all in it together. And there are enough people in developing countries who do actually have access. and who cannot participate in decision making. So I think it's an important issue, but I don't think it negates the need for increasing participation. And then in response to the other questions, I think particularly the question about is this rhetoric and more government by other means, I think no, it's not. We are not creating government. We're looking for devices that increases accountability. And I think we have to do that because of the internet and the nature of the internet, but also the nature of the world and the nature in which decisions that impact on people's lives are being made, not just by governments, but in many other places. So we are going to have to seek devices, mechanisms that increases transparency and accountability. And I think, you know, that basically says it. I think anything that impacts on the public interest, any decision that impacts on the public interest, needs to be held accountable in some way. And there are different ways of doing it. There are hard ways of doing it. There are soft ways of doing it. But I think it's our responsibility to find such ways in our particular universe, which is internet governance.
Thank you. I don't want the final word because I believe we are in the beginning of a very long conversation from this moment on. But I wanted to reflect on some of the points, and I felt some of these were not actually questions. These were very interesting contributions which we can think and incorporate in the further thinking of this idea. But, for example, I saw a link between the first and the last question, the first which was about the mechanisms employed by the Aarhus Convention, and the last being about access to justice and how is it possible. I think a significant strength in the model of Aarhus is that it manages to use actually the existing capacity of the national administrations on the place. So Aarhus doesn't have its own court or its own... Aarhus is actually a very small entity within the UNECE, the Secretariat of the Convention, but what it makes is that it's every country's government and legislation and authorities implement it. And it's a paradoxical thing which I would like to share with you in the history of the Convention, that many of the countries which signed it first were actually countries from Eastern Europe and Central Asia who were in a very initial phase of their transformation to democracy, and the reason why they accepted it and ratified it among the first is because their governments didn't actually realize immediately what they are signing up to. So actually they ended up having a legal instrument in their legislations which gave very advanced powers to civil society before many other fields of life were regulated in such a way. And the reason they did it is because environment seems to everyone like this neutral issue which... it's not so politically harmful, it's something that's of public interest, that's something we've seen in Eastern Europe. Now, here I see clearly a parallel with internet governance, because internet governance at the moment still has its aura and it is attractive, and I think many, not all, there are governments which are afraid of it already, but still I think is the moment to go ahead with this process now and harvest the momentum. And then I will finish very soon. I think, listening to this discussion, I thought what we are actually doing is we are deconstructing the term public participation, and we need to do it absolutely to the bottom. Who is the public? That was an excellent point. I mean, we are talking in the terms of Aarhus of giving access to the public in the traditional sense, but here it seems we actually may paradoxically have to be thinking of giving, or maybe governments will want to have their access in this framework. So it's a very interesting question. And then we look into the question of participation and what is participation in what? And that's a big question, but then how? And here was the good point that how would people participate if they don't have access to internet? Aarhus has some small provisions which make it an obligation of governments to use internet and information technologies. But Aarhus speaks about the right of access to information and participation without even thinking too much about access to internet. So basically the absolute value there is the access and the involvement of the civil society. So I'm maybe being a bit too provocative here. I know for this community here, access to information absolutely links to access to internet. But I would say, from my point of view, the the right and ability of citizens to participate in the process and determine the policies should start even if they are not online, I would say. There has to be mechanisms in place where they can participate before the line goes to their village. So I would say I would decouple the two and say you have to participate as early as possible. And here I stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pavel. Yes, clearly public participation in internet governance does not mean by implication that participation can only be online. It may be online, but it doesn't have to. And I think that applies to all fields of participation. We need a right and sensible mix of online and offline means of participation. So this brings us to the end of this very interesting and rich discussion, which was somewhat inconclusive, but I don't think that comes as any surprise. I have detected a general feeling that there is a need for frameworks for participation in order to enhance transparency and accountability in the field of internet governance. But we also heard that we're not quite clear as of yet who is the public on the one hand and who are the stakeholders who will be the addressees of this public participation, however it might be organized. So there is definitely a need for reflection in this respect, and also there's a need for reflection on the levels of participation. The internet obviously is an internet without borders, yet at the same time we have heard from some participants that there is a lack of participatory possibilities or opportunities at national level, as much as there is scope for public participation at international fora such as the IGF, or even as ICANN, as we heard from the responsible person at that organization. And really, to bring this all together would require some further reflection, and it would certainly be a positive challenge to bring this together in a framework far away from trying to match the Aarhus Convention as a legally binding instrument, but a soft instrument, a memorandum of understanding, it has been called, and some other proposals have been made for how to call this prospective instrument. So that, I feel, is a debate worth pursuing, and we're very glad that we have been able to provide an opportunity for discussing this novel issue, even in the framework of the IGF, hampered a bit by the late hour of the day. So this gives me the opportunity of really thanking you very warmly for having borne with us until after 7 o'clock in the evening. I'd like to thank our panelists, and I'd like to thank all of you for having been here, and hope that this discussion will be pursued at future internet governance forums and in other contexts. Thank you very much, and have a nice evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A very good job.